A chorus of all the saints praising the Lord with every instrument they can think of at the end of The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian by Debussy, who called on most of those instruments and more for that massive work. Music composed to accompany a stage performance conceived by the Italian poet and writer Gabriele D'Annunzio. Oliver Nusson giving the music its first complete airing at the Proms, conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the New London Chamber Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and soloists soprano Claire Booth and mezzos Holly May and Claire McAlden. Ollie Nusson kissing Claire Booth's hand, Claire Booth having to stand up on tiptoe. She's tiny compared with Oliver Nusson. Incidentally, the painting of the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by the Paolo Aiolo brothers that I was discussing earlier with Caroline Campbell at the National Gallery is available for you to see on the Radio 3 website, together with a longer version of our conversation. That's at bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. And here comes Claire Booth back onto the platform, followed by the chorus master, Adrian Partington, who's picking out the semi-chorus, Les Coryphées, drawn from the BBC National Chorus of Wales, which has a policy of using young singers, these eight singers just 19 or 20 years old, Vanessa Bowers, Amy Campbell, Sarah Chu, Frances Gregory, Lucy Hughes, Sean Newman, Philippa Scammell, and Eleanor Stowe. And Adrian Partington now bringing all the singers to their feet, and Ollie Nusson joining in by bringing the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra into a standing position. The leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra tonight, Anna Coleman. Well, the Proms this year marking Debussy's 150th anniversary as well as Nusson's 60th birthday. And they'll be having a total immersion in Oliver Nusson's music in November. That's the Symphony Orchestra. Listen out for more details of that. There'll be more Debussy at the Proms, his ballet Jeu, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle, in the first of their two concerts on Thursday, the 30th of August. And the Symphony Orchestra will be back for their 10th Prom on Wednesday evening, the 29th. Martin Brabins with Elgar's First Symphony, and joined by the London Philharmonic Choir and the BBC Symphony Chorus for Howell's Hymnus Paradisi. But after our own vision of paradise this evening, that's it from the Royal Albert Hall. I'll hand you back to Jonathan Swain.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall, and as well as the iPlayer for listening online over the next 7 days, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms, on Thursday the 6th of September at 2 in the afternoon. And if that St. Sebastian music has you wanting more Debussy from the Proms, there's his Sonata for Flute, Viola and Harp in Monday's Lunchtime Chamber Prom. That's at 1 o'clock on Monday. And as Louise was just saying, this Thursday evening, Debussy's Ballet Jeu is one of the pieces in the first of two Proms this year with Sir Simon Rattle and his Berlin Philharmonic. Debussy and Jeu very concerned about the sound of his score. In a letter to his friend André Caplet, he said, "I have to find an orchestration without feet for this music. I'm thinking of that orchestral colouring which seems lit from behind, and of which there are so many marvellous effects in Wagner's Parsifal." And you can hear Parsifal's Act 3 Prelude and the luminous Good Friday music in tomorrow night's Prom. Daniele Ligati conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and violinist Frank Peter Zimmermann joins them for the Berg Violin Concerto. That's here on Radio 3 at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, if you came to tonight's Prom before the Debussy, you would have heard Night Songs by Helen Grime, twice in fact, once with Oliver Nusson's glasses on, once without. And Helen Grime was also the focus of a Proms composer portrait earlier this evening, for which she was joined by presenter Tom Service.
Well, Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music in London, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall, for this Proms composer portrait of the music of Helen Grime. Now, we're going to hear three chamber pieces by Helen, all of them played by students here at the Royal College of Music. Shadow Play for soprano, saxophone and piano, To See the Summer Sky for violin and viola, and we start, though, with 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, I'm delighted you're on stage with me here. Look, you composed this piece when you were only in your late 20s. I say that given that you were only 30 last year. I mean, all the music we're going to be hearing this evening is pretty recent. But look, 10 miniatures, but it's a single movement that plays for about 5.5 minutes. How did you compress all these 10 ideas, 10 little pieces in a way, into one single movement?
Well, I wanted to write a piece where I was able to concentrate on tiny little miniatures, but I'm always thinking about the larger form. So there's a central idea, which is really quite simple, that you hear at the beginning. And my idea was that I wanted to see how I might take quite a simple idea and turn that material into quite unusual things. So often it might become something very different to the original idea. So really I wanted to set myself miniature challenges. So I'm doing very different things in these 10 movements, but also thinking about how I can create a piece which works as one movement.
And there's a big kind of expressive range you're using here, even in 5 minutes, the way that something melancholic, as you call it, goes into something exuberant. I mean, there's a big expressive range that connects these little miniatures as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I was thinking about contrasts, different speeds, very different atmospheres. But the musical material I'm using is not, that there's not very much of it, actually. It's just that I'm trying to push it as far as I possibly can. It's a bit like a sort of a compositional study for me, really.
Perfect. Look, it's a perfect place to start this selection of three of your pieces. So please welcome on stage here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, Mayuko Yamashita, to play 10 miniatures for solo piano by Helen Grime.
Thank you.
Mayuko Yamashita played Helen Grimes' 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, something about that piece that makes it quite individual in the context of your whole output and the other pieces we're going to hear tonight, which have, the other two pieces have got titles, To See the Summer Sky and Shadow Play. I mean, most of your pieces have some kind of a character or descriptive title. So 10 miniatures doesn't, and other pieces rarely do in Europe. Why is that? Is there always a kind of extra musical or inspiration or something you're going for before, that's the impulse before you start a piece?
There often is an extra musical starting point. And actually, with the 10 miniatures, there was as well. It's just that I decided not to give it a descriptive title. Sometimes I like to keep the starting point as something which is just for me, and the piece moves away from it.
But it suggests that quite a lot of, I mean, what you're doing in that first bit of composition or the first bit of inspiration is about an idea that comes from something else, whether it's a thunderstorm, I don't know, a picture, a piece of literature, that you then want to translate into music somehow. Is it a translation of an idea or is it something more complicated?
It's more that sometimes something from a line or a word in a poem or something about a picture that I'm looking at will focus my ideas in a certain way. And I'm just looking for that one sort of bit of excitement, that one sort of thing to get me going, really. And then I can move away from that. But I find that also it helps me to think of new ways of expressing things by looking at other art forms particularly.
What kind of thing are you thinking of? I mean, specific examples and pieces you've written. I mean, there's a fantastic orchestral piece called Virga, which is it's such a fantastic idea. It's based on this meteorological thing, which is rain that evaporates before it gets to the ground, which creates this wonderful effect of light, which is a kind of epiphany that inspired the piece. I mean, other examples of that kind of thing?
So, I mean, it's sort of, for that, in that instance, it was translated into a sort of musical gesture. The idea of having extremes of register, for example, or falling gestures in the music. So it can be something like that. It might be a rhythmic idea, for example. One of the movements in the piano piece, actually, which is very still, but it's the two hands are quite separate and they're sort of marking out different tempos. And, you know, it's certain ideas like that which can suggest musical things to me, I find very useful. It helps me to try and say new things. I mean, obviously there's a language there and I want to be consistent, but I also want to try and do something different in each piece.
Do you remember a time when you weren't thinking compositionally? I mean, you are a very good oboe player. You played the oboe in the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland. I mean, has music always been that sort of thing for you? Or do you remember a time when you didn't have that kind of compositional impulse?
I'm not sure. Yes, I think when I was much younger, when I was a small child, I was very interested in drawing, and that was really the thing that I would do all the time. But it always went along with music. I listened to a lot of music that came through the family. My grandparents were both music teachers. My mother's a music teacher as well. So, there was always a lot of music in the house. And, of course, I played piano and then later recorder and oboe. So it was just something that felt quite natural. And I was very, very lucky to go to a music school in Edinburgh where all students were offered composition lessons. And it was something that, you know, it was felt that everyone should try doing.
What was that like, that first experience of composing? I mean, was it difficult, or was it that moment, a kind of Damascene moment where you think, this is what I should do?
I think it's not difficult when you first sort of start composing. If only it was so easy now, but it felt something that felt very personal and special. And of course what I was doing wasn't particularly personal or original. It would be very unusual if it was at that young stage, but it felt like something precious to me.
That's a very precious thing, isn't it? I mean, that feeling that what you're doing, because I mean, presumably if it didn't feel that it was something that you had to do for yourself,
you wouldn't devote
a life to it, no. So looking back on that period now, were you influenced, though, by other composers, things that inspired you, that kicked you off?
Well, if I look back at, I actually found some early compositions quite recently, And it's they're very much influenced by French music, and particularly Debussy. I can really see that in the piano writing. And I listened to a lot of Debussy and Ravel when I was younger, and they were still composers who are hugely important for me.
What about living composers? Do you remember an encounter with a living composer that made you think, okay, composers aren't just people who write the music who aren't alive anymore, but are people around us?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a prom when I was a lot younger, and Tippett was there, and that was exciting. It's always amazing to see the person who's created this thing, and not just to think of something that, you know, the composers are all dead. So it's, yeah.
Were you attracted to, you know, the avant-garde music when you were growing up?
Yes, I was. I listened to a lot of music, and I think that expanded certainly when I came to college as well, and I started listening to much, much more. And around about that time, I heard Nussen's music, so some late teenage years, and I was immediately struck by this incredibly beautiful, precise sound world. And it just seemed to me when I heard his music for the first time that I couldn't, it just, all the notes were the right notes, and you couldn't have changed any of them. It's so, so beautiful and perfect.
Wonderful then that he's conducting, of course, the world premiere of Night Songs, your orchestral piece. Look, To See the Summer Sky, what's the story behind the right notes? I've heard it in rehearsal, I promise these are the right notes, to See the Summer Sky. What's the inspiration for this piece?
Well, actually, speaking of having an extra musical stimulus, this has a poetic title, and it's from Emily Dickinson, but the title actually came after the piece, so it wasn't the starting point. Sometimes the instruments themselves are just enough, and in this case, the violin and the viola, it's such a wonderful combination. You can make so many different sounds on string instruments, and yeah, that was really, I just went wild with it, I think, with this piece. It's a lot of fun.
Four movements, again, very sharply contrasted. As you'll hear, the fourth movement is this fantastic motor perpetuo that has all kinds of surprises in it, especially after the three movements we've heard before then. I mean, do you know when you start a piece like this, about 12, 13 minutes long, where you're going to end up when you start writing?
Well, I did in the case of this piece. This piece was interesting because the last movement I wrote first, and I actually wrote it when I was studying in Tanglewood. In America.
In Boston, near Boston.
Yeah, so the funny thing about this was one of the exercises we had to do when we were away was write a piece a day. So that last movement I wrote in a day.
You wrote that whole last movement in one day?
Yeah, I mean, it's very short, it's probably like 45 seconds, but it's very fast. There's a lot of notes in it, yeah. but then that was a good starting point then for the rest of the piece, and often starting from a different point, whether it be the end or from somewhere in the middle, can help them with generating the rest of the piece, I think.
Well, let's hear it now. So please welcome on stage here at the Royal College of Music to play Helen Grimes' To See the Summer Sky, violinist Joseph Duval and viola player Natasha Silva. Helen Grimes to see the summer sky here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music. Joseph Duval on violin and Natasha Silver on viola. Helen, so that title then came after you'd written the whole piece. Why? What's the connection then? But did you feel between that line from Emily Dickinson and that piece?
There was just something about the piece which I felt was always sort of trying to fly away. You know, it's always sort of fluttering around the extremes. It's very, very high, and it's sometimes quite ethereal, and it just sort of struck a chord with me. There's something, birds and sky, and yeah.
Look, you mentioned that composing, now you've reached the venerable age of 31, is much, you know, is harder for you now than it was 15 years ago or so. I mean, sort of basically, I mean, why? I mean, you know, you've been doing more of it. You're writing orchestral pieces, Proms commissions, pieces for the Halle, where you're associate composer now, pieces in America and Sweden, everywhere else. I mean, shouldn't it become more, shouldn't it get easier?
Yeah, but I think actually the more you know, the harder it gets. And it gets to a certain stage where you've done certain things, and you either sort of replicate those or you find new ways of saying things, and that's very difficult. And also, when you first start composing, you know, everything that you do, you're discovering something new, and it's not quite like that when you. When you've been doing it for a longer time, I think.
Is it also because you don't want to repeat yourself, that each piece is its own world in a way? Is every piece you write like a separate, completely separate world?
I hope so. It has to feel like that for me, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, that maybe everything doesn't have to be completely different, but it's sort of, you set yourself these challenges, and I think often composers make life quite difficult for themselves because of this. But I think there's a lot in the music. I mean, in that piece, it's a very detailed piece, and there are a lot of notes in it, but actually the notes really count. It's never really just textural, and it sort of takes a long time to get them all there. And that's the same then with the larger ensemble pieces and the orchestral pieces. For me, there's always, I'm thinking about different layers, and it just seems to take me a long time. For some composers, you know, they're quicker.
So what are the things then, what are the things you've discovered so far, and what are the things you want your music to discover in the future?
I mean, I'm not really sure. I'm always trying to push myself further. I'm never completely happy with a piece because I feel, I haven't achieved that ideal. And I know there's an ideal that I'm sort of looking for somewhere, and I'm sort of always trying to get to that. And I suppose that's the same with all artists, you know, always trying to reach this sort of level of more perfection.
Well, what is
that's
that?
That's what it's for me.
I mean, is that an expressive thing, a technical thing,
musical thing? It's an expressive thing. But in order to achieve that expressive thing, you need extreme sort of technical command. So I suppose I'm always trying to develop that, because I can hear if there are little kinks where the timing's not quite right, the pacing, an idea doesn't have as much impact as I would have liked.
But that might be the performers. Even if it's true that, you know, Daniel Harding and Pierre Boulez have conducted your music, there are still going to be problems with their performances, just as there are with any performance. I mean, there are things that be different. I mean, that might be their fault, not yours.
I suppose my ideal is to write a piece that, even if it's played really badly, will still sound great. I don't know if that's possible, but
it's an interesting philosophical point. Is it where the boundaries are? You still want the players to play the right notes, yeah? Or something.
Yes, like I always want the players to play the right notes, just because you know, that's something in my music which is very important, is a pitch content. So yeah, I'm always sort of listening out for the right notes.
Because I mean, from the outside, you know, as a listener, there are things that connect the music of yours that I've heard, which is it does feel as if every note has a reason to be there, and it feels also that there's a sense of line going through your pieces. Mm-hmm. I mean, even all the music we've heard so far has got tremendous expressive variety, and yet there seems to be, you know, something, some line, some even lyricism actually connecting the beginning to the end of the piece.
Yeah, that's really important to me. I mean, in a sense, I'm sort of trying to guide the listener, and not in an obvious way, but I think there is always a strong line. And I'm also looking for some sense of inevitability in the music. I want for it, you know, a climax to feel like it's in the right, for it to feel inevitable, and then to be able to surprise people also. But it's very directional, the music. It's always going towards something.
Hello, look, just before we hear Amy Green and Jennifer Hughes play Shadow Play, your piece for a soprano, sax and piano, I mean, look, who are you writing this music for? I mean, it is essentially, like for all composers, every piece you write a kind of outward manifestation of this internal dialogue and striving for perfection, or is it also got, you know, bigger circles of people who you're writing for?
No, I try only to write for myself, but I think it's difficult to know because, you know, obviously influenced by other people. And yes, I do want people to like my music. But I mean, I hope that if I like something, that some other people will like it too. So I am really writing what I want to hear, and I hope that some other people like hearing it too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, Shadow Play, this soprano, sax, and piano piece. Can you, again, there's another very redolent title there.
Yeah, I mean, what I was thinking about with this piece is that the soprano saxophone can be, it's a very strong instrument, but I was really thinking about the relationship between the piano and the saxophone. And at the beginning, the piano plays quite resonant, loud chords, and I wanted the saxophone to come out of this as if it's sort of always coming out of the shadows, moving in and out of the shadows, in and out of focus. So that was the idea really behind the beginning of the piece.
As opposed to, because it would be easy to have a saxophone and piano piece where the piano is kind of always in the saxophone shadow, given how loud an instrument it is.
Exactly, yeah. So I sort of wanted to play with that a little bit, and they become equal in the last movement. But the second movement is for solo saxophone. But again, it's in three movements, but I think it really, it's in one movement, really, but in three sections.
Helen, thank you. Well, let's hear it now. Helen Grimes, Shadow Play, Amy Green, soprano saxophone, and Jennifer Hughes on piano.
Thank you.
That was Shadow Play by Helen Grime, played by Amy Green on soprano saxophone and Jennifer Hughes on piano. And it ends that Proms composer portrait of Helen Grime, given earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music in London. The performers were all Royal College students, and the presenter was Tom Service. Well, my apologies after tonight's live prom. We're running a little late. But next on Radio 3, Here and Now, presented by Ivan Hewitt.
Hello. Well, with the Olympics behind us and the Paralympics about to start next week, in today's programme we salute the vast cultural jamboree that is London 2012 with the last two of New Music 20x12. These were 20 new pieces, commissioned to be 12 minutes in length, all designed to mark the Olympic year and to reflect the Games' general theme of faster, higher, stronger. We'll find out how Shima Mukherjee and Richard Corston took these ambitions on board in their new works tonight. And the latest instalment of the Here and Now 50 looks at one of those cult pieces of the 1970s which just keeps coming round in new guises. Gavin Bryars' Jesus Blood Never Failed Me Yet. So, on to the first of those 20x12 commissions. This is one which really broke the mould of the typical new music premiere. It was commissioned from Shima Mukherjee, a sitar player and composer who's one of the UK's best-known fusion musicians. She studied with reverend masters of Hindustani classical music, including Nikhil Banerjee, but in her own work she collaborates with musicians across every musical divide, from electronica to folk. Her 20x12 piece is called Bending the Dark, and it was created in collaboration with the multicultural performing group The Imagined Village. Shima Mukherjee.
The Imagined Village is a collective, I would say. It includes English traditional musicians, Indian traditional musicians, and quite a lot of electronica. When I applied for the 2012 Olympics Commission for the Cultural Olympiad, I thought to myself, well, what do I write? How do I write it? You know, the band itself is such an interesting group and there's a lot of fun in it as well. There's a lot of comedy there. And then I thought, well, I mean, my background is through Indian classical music, and in Indian classical music, each note has a meaning. For example, your tonic, it means infinity. The second note is sorrow. Third is peace. Fourth is romance. And the sixth note, which is dha, is heroic. And I thought, heroic, that's a good point to start. And so originally the piece was actually called Bending the Dha, as opposed to Bending the Dark. And it was actually a typo that occurred with me and Simon Emerson. He put Bending the Dark in there. And I thought, well, actually, there's also an opposite character to each note. And for the tar, the opposite character is disgust. So I thought probably best to keep it as Bending the Dark. And actually, it has quite a lot of meaning for a lot of people. The way I wrote the piece of music, I actually had the end part. And then myself and Martin Carthy, we used to noodle a little tune called Cuckoo's Nest. I won't tell you what that means, it's quite rude, but we used to noodle this little tune, and I used to really like it. It was a very positive, happy tune. And I thought to myself, it would be quite nice to incorporate that tune within the 12-minute piece. So it's the actual piece is based around the kind of heroic centre of what I feel is the Olympics. And The Cuckoo's Nest, which are two little positive pieces. And I have kept some sections which are improvised. It's within a constraints, because that's what we do. And it was actually remarkably easy to put it together. I was worried. I have to say, I was quite worried about how I would show people, for example, the way we work, the way we break up timing, 7.5 beats. How do you break that up? I break it up differently from the way a Western musician would do it, but then it's 15. But I wouldn't kind of expect the listeners to actually even notice that it's something quite complicated, because fundamentally I work with something that feels comfortable. If it didn't feel comfortable, I wouldn't have written it or put it together in that way.
Sa sa ni sa sa ma ni ni sa.